Under Evidence Rule 608, evidence of a witness's truthful character is admissible only after the character of the witness for truthfulness has been attacked. In a case involving indecent liberties with a child, the Court of Appeals has now held that impeaching the victim with evidence of prior inconsistent statements does not constitute an attack on the victim's character for truthfulness, opening the door to rehabilitation. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Braswell, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina. John, before we move on to the cases decided by the Court of Appeals on January 21st, there was one other case from January 7th we wanted to talk about. Tell us about State v. Oaks.
Sure. State versus Oaks is a case that we got out of Vance County on January 7th. The defendant here was charged with the murder for the strangulation and death of his mother, a woman named Geraldine Oaks, which occurred back on May 24th of 2017. Jumping ahead, just to sort of summarize the evidence that comes out at trial, it shows that he went to trial on January 29th of 2024, and the evidence showed that Geraldine and the defendant's father, Robert, they were married, they had three children. The defendant lived in a mobile home beside his parents' house in Youngsville, and that the parents, Robert and Geraldine, also owned a house up on Carr Lake up in Vance County. On May 24th was when Geraldine drove up to the house to get it cleaned up before Memorial Day weekend, and when she arrived, she texted her husband, Robert, to let him know that the defendant was also there, and Robert finishes up some work, and then he starts heading up that way. At 12:54 p.m. on that day, the daughter, Caitlin, gets a voicemail that is sent to her from her mother, Geraldine's phone, and she's finishing up a class, but she listens to the voicemail shortly after, and it seems like it's an accidental dial that was being made, but what she can hear on there are the voices of her mother and her brother, the defendant, and they're having what sounds like an argument. And the defendant is yelling at their mother, Geraldine, you know, why did you come up here, and some unintelligible stuff, but then seems to be screaming at her about something about you're to die and get the fuck out of my face. So Caitlin calls her mother back first, but gets no answer, calls her father, tells him what she heard, that it sounded really bad. When Robert gets up to the lake house, he sees that Geraldine's car is there, finds the defendant out in the driveway, asks the defendant what happened and where is your mother, where is Geraldine. He says, you ain't got to worry about her. I done took care of her. She's dead. And then Robert, unfortunately, does find her in a bedroom with a rope that is tightly wrapped around her neck several times. So they call 911. The husband is trying to resuscitate her, but is unable to do that. There's a bolo that's put out, and the defendant is stopped and arrested in Youngsville shortly after. So prior to that, he is ultimately convicted at the trial on February 1st of 2024 and got life without parole. But prior to all that happening, there was this matter that happened at a pretrial hearing back in October of 2023. And that sort of sets up the first issue we're going to talk about, dealing with some questions of capacity and defenses. But the defense counsel had indicated to the court that he wanted to pursue defenses of diminished capacity and insanity, but wanted to review the latest records and had not yet had a chance to discuss it with the defendant. So the trial judge then conducts a colloquy with the defendant to ask him about that. And the judge is asking sort of several different ways, several different times to try to get an answer from the defendant, saying, your attorney wants to make these arguments about your diminished capacity or insanity. Are you okay with that? Do you consent to that? And it seems to take a minute for the defendant to really understand exactly what he's asking. But ultimately, the defendant says to the judge, I am not in agreeance with that. No, ma'am. I'm definitely not in agreeance at all. I've been mentally capable of being to proceed the entire time. There's been, this is direct quote, there's been type of misunderstanding, and ultimately saying, I would hope he wouldn't be arguing that I wasn't mentally capable. And so, based on that, the judge decides that we are not going to have that as a feature in the case. So, as I said, he was convicted, got life without parole, and there's five issues that are set up on appeal. And the first of these is this question about diminished capacity or insanity, these defenses. And the defendant is arguing that he never knowingly and intelligently waived his right to present those defenses. But Court of Appeals doesn't really dig into that. They're saying that he failed to preserve that issue for appellate review, that defense counsel did not object at the time to this ruling from the court, that we were not going to present those defenses, and so there was nothing that was preserved, so they don't really dig into that. So then, of course, the defense's next argument on appeal is about ineffective assistance of counsel, saying that I was denied the chance to do this. My attorney messed up, basically, by not pursuing these defenses that I don't think I adequately waived. But the Court of Appeals sort of dismisses that one as well, that it was the trial court that prohibited the defense counsel from presenting diminished capacity or insanity defenses. And so they explain that the defendant has failed to allege, much less show, that counsel's performance was deficient, and that's what's required under the first prong of Strickland. You know, instead, the defendant is essentially arguing that the trial court erred, but that is the issue that wasn't really preserved down below, about whether that was an error being made by the trial court. So dismissing the first two of these five pretty easily. The third issue raised is a question about competency, and he's making two issues here. The first is that he's saying that the court erred by just adopting a forensic psychiatrist evaluation that was done back at a May of 2023 competency hearing, and second, arguing that the trial court should have conducted another competency hearing sua sponte. And that's something we didn't really discuss yet, is that the defendant had been diagnosed with schizophrenia for several, I think 5 years leading up to trial, and he actually twice lost and regained capacity to stand trial. And so the trial judge had ordered that he remain in the hospital until the trial date so that he could get his medication and the mental health treatment that he needed to remain competent to stand trial. But looking at all of that, they reject both of these arguments. First, they say it was not error for the trial court to make its findings as to his competency or capacity by essentially just adopting what was in the report that was prepared by the doctors who evaluated him. They reference a case, State versus Coley, and they talk about how they've said the better practice is to make independent, detailed findings of fact, but adopting the facts set forth in the report is not necessarily error, and it certainly was not prejudicial in this case. And they talk about that competency report that was previously done. It did have pretty detailed notes about the interviews that were done, everything that was observed, all the recommendations and findings. And so in this case, yes, it was okay for the judge to just say, my finding is I'm adopting the findings from this report. It would be a better practice to actually write those out for yourself, but didn't see an issue here. The other prong or other part of this is the defense's argument that given everything else that was going on, everything that you saw, the trial judge erred by not sua sponte asking for yet another competency evaluation to be done. And the Court of Appeals disagrees with that as well. They point out that a trial judge is only required to do a sua sponte competency hearing when, quote, there is a bona fide doubt as to the defendant's competency. And we just didn't really have that here. I mean, yes, he had some mental health issues, but again, he was in hospital right now to make sure that he was given the medication he was supposed to get, that he could be observed, and that he would remain competent to stand trial. And then on top of that, you know, maybe the phrasing wasn't perfect, but in that colloquy they had, for example, about, you know, these insanity or diminished capacity defenses, he is lucid and clear in talking with the judge. He understands what's being asked of him. He's expressing his opinion. No, I don't want my attorney to do that. He's giving the reasons why, saying, I think I am competent. You know, he's participating and engaging. And so there wasn't the kind of obvious question that would raise that bona fide doubt in a reasonable judge's mind to say, even though we've done it before, we need to do it again. Let's have another capacity evaluation. We didn't have that here. The fourth big issue that's being raised is dealing with this voicemail message about the authentication for that and a question under Rule 901 about whether the trial court erred admitting that voicemail. And the defense is saying that really was not properly authenticated. The way that it was authenticated at trial is that the witness I mentioned, the defendant's sister, the one who got the voicemail, testified that she remembered it and that she recognized the voices on that recording. You know, she obviously knows her mother and her brother's voice. And so she recognized their voices on the recording. That was sufficient to authenticate it. The defense is arguing that it should not have been. He's saying, for example, when she testified about that voicemail, she said that she had heard it at the time. She even listened to it again the morning before she testified. And, you know, she is saying she recognizes the voices, although she said that she thought the message or she recalled the message being longer than the one that was being played at trial. But nevertheless, she did believe it was accurate. Long story short, the Court of Appeals is saying that was sufficient to authenticate this message, right? Under Rule 901B5, one of the ways we can authenticate a recording is a person who is familiar with those voices, has had an opportunity to hear them, listens to it and says, yes, I know those voices. I can tell you that that is an authenticated recording. And then there was a second component that was actually a forensic analyst that was offered as a state's witness who testified about the process of extracting the data from the defendant's sister's phone, you know, actually pulling that voicemail off and providing it here in court. And so that was sufficient under 901B5 to authenticate the voicemail and, you know, any conflicting evidence about, but wait, you know, is it possible it could have been longer or something like that? That would go to the weight or the credibility of the evidence, not to its admissibility. So, Joe, I thought this was an interesting case because I sort of add it to a pile of some other cases we've had recently dealing more with video. You know, we're kind of in a brave new world. It is not as hard as it used to be to make an incredibly convincing recording, whether it be video or audio. And yet, you know, for the moment, I think the cases are still holding the line at saying, hey, 901B5, you recognize those voices, or 901B4, distinctive characteristics, even on video, is enough to authenticate it. And that appears to be the rule here as well. But, you know, I guess maybe my takeaway for prosecutors would be, even if it is sufficient to get it admitted, we should probably also bear in mind that jurors are reading the same news stories we are about things like AI or faked videos, audio recordings, and that kind of thing. So, you know, we really want to double down on convincing the jury. We get it admitted, that's great. But let's make sure we're also giving the jury what they need to know that to be sure that they can trust it. Like in this case, where we have a forensic analyst extracting it from the phone. So we know it was a real phone call and an unaltered recording that was being made on that phone.
Yeah, was there any language in Oakes, Jonathan, about the possibility of tampering, or the defendant has neglected to present any evidence sufficient to show that there's a meaningful possibility that this recording has been doctored or manipulated? I mean, because we see that in some of these cases, it almost sounds as if the burden is on the opponent of the evidence to show the possibility of tampering. But as you said, in this kind of world we're in now, the ease at which people have access to AI tools, it seems like the possibility of manipulation has gotten greater.
It has. And, you know, I think those cases we've seen on that, they talk about if it's possible, it could have been altered. And there is some reason to think it may have been altered. You know, then I think we've got more of kind of a chain of custody issue. But short of that, I think they're kind of sticking to that rule that says, we're talking about authentication, you know, and we've had all these cases. State v. Ford is one that we always talk about, that the only showing that's required to authenticate is a prima facie showing that it is what it purports to be. And all prima facie showing means is there is something in the record from which the finder of fact could conclude that it is what it purports to be. You know, and beyond that, it's really a question of argument. You know, if the defense attorney wants to argue to the jury about why they should believe this is actually a fake recording and he never said what he said, I make that argument, you know, and I'm just saying, number one, we should remind the judge that's not the test for admitting it and getting it in front of the jury for them to consider. But we don't want to be too dismissive. You know, we need to bear in mind that jurors may have questions about this stuff these days. And so we want to really highlight, you know, the sister's certainty, the analyst extracting it from the phone, the fact that it's been preserved in an evidence locker since the day it was pulled and nobody else has touched it. We may want to do a little more on that chain of custody than we used to with this kind of digital evidence, even if that's not an elevated requirement. It's certainly something we want to be conscious of.
Right.
So then, Joe, the next one we had up was the one you forecast, that State versus Braswell.
State v. Braswell. This is a case out of Johnston County. The facts of the case were these. The victim, whom the Court of Appeals calls Penny, and the defendant's daughter, Kate, were best friends. Basically, due to problems at home, defendant and his wife cared for Penny and her twin brother. There was evidence that he took them on vacation, hosted them at Christmas time. When Penny was about 12 years old, she started working in the office at the defendant's RV park. On April 18th, 2022, defendant asked Penny to meet her in the conference room at the RV park. When they were alone, defendant unbuttoned her pants and touched her vagina with his fingers. A few months later, in June of 2022, Penny disclosed the improper touching to a friend during a birthday party. She later told Kate, her good friend, who was the defendant's daughter, then defendant's wife while Kate was present, and then her grandmother. The next morning, Penny went to the Johnson County Sheriff's Office and reported the touching to law enforcement. In August of 2022, defendant was indicted for one count of taking indecent liberties with a child. The matter came on for trial by jury in September of 2024. Penny testified at trial against the defendant, and then during cross-examination, defense counsel pointed out inconsistencies in her story. He emphasized the delay in the disclosure. Apparently, it was a few months between the time that the touching occurred and when she reported it. And he also questioned whether Penny was upset at the defendant for reporting that Penny's mother was using drugs in violation of her probation. The Court of Appeals suggests that's some kind of evidence of bias against the defendant. Based on the defendant's impeachment of the victim, the trial court then allowed the state to present five witnesses who testified to Penny's good character for truthfulness. Defendant was convicted of indecent liberties and appealed. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant argued that the trial court erred by allowing those five character witnesses to testify as to Penny's good character for truthfulness because the defendant did not open the door to that testimony. As I said in the introduction, under Evidence Rule 608, evidence of truthful character is admissible only after the character of the witness for truthfulness has been attacked. The Court of Appeals said that not all attacks on credibility trigger rehabilitation. Pointing out that the North Carolina case law, he says this is an issue that our courts have yet to thoroughly address, the Court of Appeals looked to federal case law and noted that federal case law distinguishes between direct and indirect attacks. Impeachment methods challenging a witness's general character for truthfulness, such as attacks on the witness's character for untruthfulness or evidence of a prior conviction, constitute indirect attacks that trigger rehabilitation under Rule 608. By contrast, impeachment methods challenging the witness's truthfulness in the instant case, such as pointing out inconsistencies in prior statements, the Court of Appeals said, do not qualify as attacks on character for truthfulness, opening the door to this kind of rehabilitation. And then with regard to that bias evidence, the Court of Appeals said suggestion of bias does not constitute an attack on the witness's character for truthfulness. Here, the defendant challenged Penny's credibility by pointing out inconsistencies in her testimony and prior statements, by highlighting the details that Penny failed to disclose early on, and by attempting to establish some kind of bias against the defendant. The Court of Appeals said that defense counsel's questions implied that Penny was mistaken or lying about the facts of the instant case, not that she was a liar in general, and that these attacks on credibility do not trigger rehabilitative evidence under Rule 608. It said the same thing was true of evidence of bias. So finding that the trial court erred in allowing these character witnesses to testify to Penny's good character for truthfulness, the Court of Appeals then addressed the question of whether the defendant was prejudiced by that error. It said that because Penny's credibility was the central issue in this case, the Court of Appeals concluded that the rehabilitation testimony was prejudicial. Absent the testimony, it said there's a reasonable possibility that the outcome of the trial would have been different. So it granted the defendant a new trial based on the prosecutors putting on these character witnesses where the defendant's impeachment of the victim did not open the door to character witnesses under Rule 608.
Joe, I have to say, this case surprised me. I mean, this is just not a distinction that I feel like I've really seen drawn out very much. In I mean, I guess the case law or just in the, I don't know, the trial experience that I've had. Prior to this case, I would have thought, I mean, if somebody is attacking my state's witness about, oh, well, you know, you just testified that it happened at 10 a.m. and isn't it true you told the police it was at 10:30? Are you lying then? Or are you lying now? You know, these attacks on a witness, I would have confidently said, of course, I could then bring in rehabilitative witnesses to say, hey, I've known John Holbrook for 25 years. He's an honest guy. And yet, this direct, indirect kind of distinction that they're drawing. I mean, is that, you know, they reference a lot of federal case law for sort of making these points. Is this new? Or are they actually drawing this from the North Carolina case law?
Yeah, I think that distinction between a direct and indirect attack is drawn, as the Court of Appeals acknowledges here, from the federal case law. The place that I find the Court of Appeals opinion kind of a weakness in the analysis is this suggestion that our courts have yet to thoroughly address this issue. There is, in fact, North Carolina case law on what sort of impeachment will open the door to this kind of rehabilitation. As you pointed out, I think there is inconsistent case law on that. There is certainly authority for the proposition that pointing out prior inconsistent statements under the North Carolina case law would have opened the door to these rehabilitation witnesses testifying to the witness's good character. At the same time, there are more recent North Carolina Supreme Court opinions that say, in essence, that not every impeachment constitutes an attack on character that will open the door to character evidence. There is one case, for example, and I think it's the one cited here, Caballero, where the state's challenge to the medical examiner's cause of death identified on a death certificate was not a challenge to the witness's character for truthfulness, opening the door to rehabilitation by character witnesses. The North Carolina case law is mixed, to say the least. But yeah, I think you're right. This specific distinction between a direct attack and an indirect attack is one that the Court of Appeals has imported from the federal case law. And moving forward, I think suffice to say, it will be more difficult to show that the impeachment opens the door to that kind of character witness moving forward.
So I'm also just trying to wrap my head around what would be a kind of indirect attack on truthfulness that would open the door for this kind of general rehabilitation. So I'm only going to be able to bring in the rehabilitative witness who's going to say, I've known John Holbrook 20 years. He's an honest guy. I'm only going to put that person on the stand if the defense has called some other witness to say, I've known John Holbrook 20 years and he's not an honest guy. I mean, it's got to just be this broad, indirect kind of attack to support the broad, indirect rehabilitation.
Yes, that's one of the two examples that the Court of Appeals gives as the kind of impeachment that would allow a character witness, is where there was evidence of the witness's character for untruthfulness. So as you pointed out, putting on another witness to say, I know that guy and I know that he's a liar. The other example they give is evidence of a prior conviction under Rule 609, the suggestion that because a defendant has been convicted of a felony, you should infer that he's lying in that case. That kind of impeachment would open the door to a good character witness as well. Beyond that, we don't have any examples specifically in this opinion for what would open the door to character witnesses, but it does seem that this opinion creates some inconsistency with the prior North Carolina Court of Appeals cases, holding that merely, as you pointed out, pointing out inconsistent prior statements does open the door for character witnesses.
If they're impeaching my witness with a prior conviction, that would be the other time.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
And then the last case I think we had on for today was State v. Robinson.
So this is another case from the January 21st of 2026 set, a case out of Alamance County. And this one is broadly dealing with primarily the order of closing arguments at a jury trial. And then also, I think, an interesting take on dealing with expert testimony in the wake of Smith v. Arizona. But what we're talking about is an incident that happened back on September 14th of 2021. The victim in the case, a person named Robert Starmer, told his friend, a person named Adlai Walters, that he wanted to go and get some heroin. And so the Starner calls up the defendant in this case, and then Starner, Walters, and Starner's girlfriend, a woman named Cora Bott, all drive about 30 minutes away to a residential house to get the drugs. Starner goes up to the door, talks with the defendant, comes back to the vehicle, and in the vehicle, he then snorts a small amount of drugs from his hands, and Bott also takes some of those drugs. Shortly after snorting the drugs, Starner is driving away from the house, but very rapidly begins driving erratically. He's going too fast. He's talking crazy. So this friend, Walters, who did not take any of the drugs, tells him to stop the car. Walters gets in and takes over as the driver. He's trying to ask them for directions about how to get back to the girlfriend's apartment, but neither of them are responsive. So instead, he ends up just driving back to town and goes to Starner's parents' house. When he gets to the house, he thinks that the victim in the case and his girlfriend are basically just sleeping off the drugs. So he parks the car, takes the keys, goes inside the house, and tells Starner's mother that both Starner and his girlfriend Bott are outside in the car. He's left the keys in the house to make sure that they don't try to drive. He checks on them one last time, goes back inside to tell the parents that he's going to be leaving. And then the last time he checked on them, he could see them in the back. They were still in some kind of apparent distress. He describes them as squirming or making noises, but they are alive. Unfortunately, at about 12:30 a.m. on September 15th, a 911 call comes in to the Burlington Police Department for an overdose call out at the house. EMS and police are dispatched. When they get there, the girlfriend, Bott, has difficulty breathing, but she ultimately does survive. EMS is unable to revive the victim, Starner. He died at the scene. When this friend, Walters, learns about what has happened, he comes back to the scene. He talks to the police about what happened the night before. He cooperates with them, works with them to figure out where it was they had gone to purchase the drugs. They are able to locate that house. Officers on September 16th speak with the defendant at a friend's house. They search her bag. They discover that she's got a substance on her they suspect is fentanyl. She agrees to do an interview, initially denies selling to either of these two victims, but later admits that she did. They also do a search warrant of her home, find drugs and other evidence like scales and baggies and things there. They've also recovered some text messages showing communications with Starmer and Bott going back for a couple of years. So the victim in this case, an examination is done on his body by Dr. Aurelius, the chief medical examiner, and he's an expert in pathology and forensic pathology, does not do a full autopsy on the victim. victim's body, but does take samples of the urine. That is tested. It comes back positive for methamphetamine, cocaine, fentanyl, amphetamines, and THC. And those are also submitted for a toxicology examination at the lab. Dr. Brower is a forensic toxicologist and expert who approved basically Starner's toxicology report that was performed by other forensic chemists using this liquid chromatography technique. And in his expert opinion, the lab results from those toxicology reports indicated that Starner had used methamphetamine, cocaine, and fentanyl prior to his death, and more specifically, that the amount of fentanyl in his body was sufficiently fatal. So the case comes on for trial, and at trial, the state ended up giving both the first opening closing final argument as well as the last closing argument, and the defendant followed both times. The defendant objected to that procedure because the defendant said, hey, I never put on any evidence, so I should have had the right to open the closing arguments and also give the last or final closing arguments, and in fact, moved for a mistrial on those grounds, but the court denied that. Jury found the defendant guilty of all the charges, entered a consolidated sentence, and the defendant was sentenced to a total of 60 to 84 months in prison. So there's a couple of issues that we're talking about on appeal. The first of those is the last thing I just mentioned about the fact that defense counsel was not allowed to make the whatever we want to call the first or the opening of the closing arguments at the trial. That is governed by Rule 10 of General Rules of Practice for the Superior and District Courts. And Rule 10 says exactly that. It says that if no evidence is introduced by the defendant, the right to open and close the arguments to the jury shall belong to him. So there's not really much question here that the trial judge made a mistake, and the defendant should have been allowed to have that first argument. Really, the question is, what does that mean now? You know, I mean, was that a prejudicial error, or was it error per se to deny that? And that's a valid question, because we've had other cases where if the judge made that mistake and did not give the defendant, for example, the right to the final argument with the jury, cases have recognized we're going to presume error there. We really feel like there is a lot of value or power in having that final say with the jury and leaving them with that last impression before they go back into the jury room. And so the question really here is, do we say the same thing about the right to have the first of the closing arguments? Do we treat it the same way? There's a lot of discussion in here about whether the defendant did or did not actually offer evidence, and that's not really relevant for our discussion. But presuming that he did not offer evidence in the case and was therefore erroneously denied the right to this opening argument, they say that here the defendant, they will not make that same presumption of prejudice, that the defendant would have to prove prejudice. And the defendant tried to make some arguments to that effect, you know, talking about how if I'd had that opening argument, I could have gotten out ahead of the state and sort of, you know, set in the jury's mind how they should view the law. They make some arguments or maybe claims to that effect about why how they think that this court should look at it. But here, the Court of Appeals says the defendant inadequately explains that there was a reasonable possibility of a different verdict absent the error, especially in the face of the evidence mounted against her. Thus, we refrain from granting defendant a new trial. So we're not saying it was an error, and we're not even saying that it would necessarily never be a prejudicial error that the defendant didn't get that opening argument, but it is at least going to be on the defense to prove that prejudice, and they did not offer really anything concrete to show that here. So we're not going to reverse just for that.
The interesting thing about this, the source of this rule, it comes from, I think you said the rules for district and superior court.
Right,
right. These are rules promulgated by the North Carolina Supreme Court, but they don't necessarily appear in any statute. But this is something that I guess parties just have to know going forward, that if you're looking for the rules governing who gets the first last argument and who gets to go first, depending on what evidence is introduced, you've got to go to that, I think you said Rule 10 of the Rules of District and Superior Court.
Exactly. But it's also important to know and be aware of the case law interpreting some of those rules, you know, because this dealing with the losing the closing argument, erroneously being denied the last word before the jury goes back to deliberate, that we've found to be error, and other circumstances as well. If the defendant has more than one attorney and we've denied an opportunity for both of them, you know, there are those kinds of circumstances. But Joe, I mean, we've also seen cases where, for example, these rules also talk about manner of examination of witnesses, the order of presentation of evidence at a trial. And some of those are going to be left to the judge's discretion. If the judge, for example, wants to let another witness come in, or even to
reopen direct examination.
To reopen direct examination. Those kind of things are going to be in the judge's discretion. But this is one where you're exactly right. It's just a rule of practice, and yet it may have reversal implications in some circumstances, but evidently not in this one where we're just talking about that first argument. So then the second issue, the one that jumped out at me a little bit more, was dealing with this expert testimony. And the defendant here did not raise this issue at trial. So we sort of need to make that point first. They're waived appellate review. And the Court of Appeals agrees with that, but then goes on to say, even assuming it was properly preserved, we would find no error here. And what the defense is arguing, at least now at the appellate level, is saying we have a Smith v. Arizona confrontation clause problem, right? Because—
And remind us, that's the case where there's this substitute expert testimony, right? An expert who maybe didn't conduct the forensic analysis himself, but says, I've reviewed the data that was conducted by another expert, and I find that I would reach the same conclusion.
Right. And so just, you know, in a nutshell, in North Carolina, we've had a long series of cases that have said, that's fine, right? We can bring in the second expert and he can talk about what the prior or other expert did, because all of that stuff was just the basis of his opinion, right? And so we could get into that under Rule 703. So we have a way to get past the hearsay issue. And then Smith v. Arizona said, we're not going to really accept that interpretation or that approach, right? Because what those other witnesses would say, it only has value if we take it for the truth of the matter asserted. Your current testifying expert's opinion only has value, only has relevance if we are taking what these other people said for the truth of the matter asserted. So, you know, we have this hearsay issue. Now, unresolved in Smith v. Arizona was, are those statements testimonial, right? Because sure, it's hearsay, that's fine. But Rule 703 is a hearsay exception, right? That would be allowed. It's only going to be a confrontation issue if those statements are also deemed testimonial. But in this case, we sort of go a different way to all of that. What they're talking about is making reference back to, for example, another recent case we had called State v. Lester that reiterated the point that—
North Carolina Supreme Court case, right?
Exactly. A case that we just got, I think, in 2025, where they were reiterating this idea of, we're not talking about confrontation clause at all if we're talking about computer data. You know, computers are not people and data are not statements. And so if we've just got data being spit out by a computer, we're not talking about hearsay at all, much less testimonial hearsay that might raise a confrontation clause issue. Significantly, in this case, they say that's what the opinion really is based on. The witness that the state brought in, they say that an expert's testimony regarding a toxicology report containing machine-generated data does not violate the Sixth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Dr. Brower relied on drug test results produced by other forensic chemists. However, the forensic chemists did not use their judgments or independently opine on the quantity of each drug in Starner's system. Rather, a machine-produced chromatograph provided the data. And then Dr. Brower analyzed the data, and then that's the opinion that he's giving.
Well, hold on a second. Lester was about cell phone records, wasn't it? It was about data that was collected by a machine and produced by a machine. The difference here is somebody had to carry the laboratory slide from the body to the microscope.
So that, Joe, I think is the interesting part of this that maybe we still don't have a perfect answer to, right? Because you're exactly right. Yes, the data coming out of the machine or coming out of the instrument, that is clearly not a statement. But are we still in some way relying on statements of other analysts, other experts who are not here in court because somebody in a report wrote down, I took the sample out of the evidence bag, I put it on a slide, I put it in the machine. Are we still relying on that for the truth of the matter asserted in order for this testifying expert's opinion to actually have any relevance or mean anything? Maybe so, but I think this is getting us a step closer to another argument that we've sort of talked about in the past that, but those kind of statements are not testimonial. That's more like chain of custody almost, of just sort of explaining how the evidence from the scene got into the chromatograph, or at least that would be an angle that we might explore in some cases going forward.
But yeah, but just to play devil's advocate here, how you think of this situation of Sir Walter Raleigh before the Star Chamber, right? I mean, how is the defendant meaningfully supposed to challenge whether this machine was working properly if we don't have the testimony of the person who was actually turning the dials?
I guess he does at least have this expert in court that he can confront, right? I mean, that he's giving his opinion. And I guess I would almost say that's more like attacking the the weight, not the admissibility of it, right? I mean, if you want to raise an issue about, well, but you're just telling us what a machine said, and, you know, should we or should we not trust the machine? Well, then maybe that's an argument you could make. But just as to the admissibility of the opinion, when all I'm telling you is, here's my opinion based on data that I'm looking at, and the data came from a computer, and a computer's not a person, and data are not statements, then we couldn't possibly have this confrontation clause issue here. There's maybe a little bit of a lingering question about what about the statements setting up the computer data, and we'll just have to see how that gets teased out. But even without that, it's significant that in this opinion, they feel like that's a question we don't need to answer. That wasn't really something that was raised. The last thing in this case that we'll talk about is this question about the sentencing consolidation, or sort of a double jeopardy issue. The defendant here was prosecuted basically for death by distribution and also sale of a controlled substance, and was arguing to give me sentences for both of those is a double jeopardy violation. The Court of Appeals says it's not. They do that Blockberger analysis about what is double jeopardy, and they say that we look to see, does each of these offenses have a requirement or an element that the other does not? And they see that distinction between death by distribution and sale or delivery of a controlled substance. Death by distribution, of course, we're talking about the actual, at the time anyway, the sale and only the sale of a substance resulting in the death of the person, whereas sale or delivery of a controlled substance could be other kinds of delivery, not just sale, and also encompasses other kinds of drugs, not just the limited number that would support death by distribution. And then finally, they spent some time discussing...
Well, hold on a second, because there's U.S. Supreme Court case law that says for double jeopardy analysis, even when you're doing that Blockbuster's test, sometimes it requires you to look at the state's theory, right? I'm thinking of felony murder. I mean, an element of murder, armed robbery, for example, is not always an element of murder. But when you're prosecuting a defendant for felony murder based on an armed robbery, that armed robbery is a lesser included offense. So the mere possibility that the supposed lesser included can be proven in a different way is not conclusively going to establish that it's not a lesser included offense in this case. How does the Court of Appeals get around that?
I would agree with you. I think it's a somewhat, I don't know, we might say difficult or questionable analysis on sort of these elements. You know, that Blockberger test, what it really talks about is whether each provision requires proof of a fact, which the other does not. And I'm not sure that necessarily applies to what's going on here. I mean, yes, sale and delivery could be proved by things that would fall outside of the death by distribution, right? We could have a delivery, but not a sale. We could have mushrooms, not fentanyl. There are ways we could get out of there. I'm not sure that that's really meeting that test, though, of saying that it requires. But then, Joe, I think the part you and I had talked about earlier is, I think in your view, those two may fall away, but this third justification they offer is the one that probably makes the most sense about whether it is or isn't, you know, required different elements. It seems to be the legislative intent.
Right. That's really should be the meaningful question for when you're talking about a sentencing error constituting double jeopardy. The pertinent question is only whether the legislature intended for the defendant to be sentenced for both. And I think what the Court of Appeals here says is there is legislative intent that it did.
Yeah, exactly. They talk about, you know, the preamble to the session law enacting the death by distribution and sort of review all their statements. And based on that, they say the General Assembly's intent to particularly punish illegal drug dealing that ends in the death of a user is a separate intent from punishing solely the sale or delivery of a controlled substance.
You see that same kind of thing. I mean, particularly when you're dealing with drug offenses, the courts have found legislative intent for multiple punishment for, say, trafficking by possession, trafficking by transportation. You can get both trafficking charges based on the same controlled substance because the legislature intended for you to be sentenced for both.
In their view, we've kind of got the same thing here. Like, yes, even if they are duplicative, that's the point. We want there to be this additional punishment when it results in a death. The last thing in the case was an argument for ineffective assistance of counsel, talking about this, his counsel's failure to object to this expert testimony or object to him being convicted of both death by distribution and sale of a controlled substance. They find no prejudice here since they don't believe that either of those issues were in fact error. So based on all of that, the panel concludes there was no error and the other two judges concur.
Well, that's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Oaks, concluding a voicemail message was sufficiently authenticated by voice recognition. State v. Braswell, holding the trial court erred by admitting character evidence to rehabilitate a witness when the witness's character for truthfulness had not been attacked. And State v. Robinson, finding no violation of the defendant's Confrontation Clause rights in the admission of machine-generated data. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We're coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, if there's an issue you'd like for us to cover in a later episode, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Thanks, Joe. Sounds good. Hope it helped.